Like that.
My guest today is Dan Kittredge, who knows more about what makes food nutritious than anyone I know. Dan Kittredge has been an organic farmer for more than 30 years and is the founder and executive director of the BioNutrient Food Association, a non-profit whose mission is to increase the quality in the food supply. Known as one of the leading proponents of nutrient density, Dan works to demonstrate the connections between soil health, plant health, and human health. Out of these efforts was born the BioNutrient Institute, which has engineered a prototype of a handheld consumer spectrometer designed to test nutrient density at the point of purchase. How amazing is that? And via the BioNutrient meter, the goal is to empower consumers to choose for nutrition quality and thereby leverage economic incentives to drive full system regeneration. He has decades of experience literally testing growing methods and measuring the nutrient density both in plants and livestock. As people extol the benefits of organic, zero-dig, regenerative farming, and the harms of our herbicide and pesticide-laden food supply, Dan has actually been measuring and working out what farmers and growers have to do to get the healthiest soil for the healthiest plants. Not only am I honored to have Dan as my podcast guest, but he's also coming to our farm in the Black Mountains in June to teach us and other growers and gardeners how to grow super nutritious food. If you're interested in that, check out the events section on foodforthebrain.org. So, Dan, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you so much, Patrick, and I'm totally honored to be in conversation with you. When I realized everything that you had been doing for the last 40 years, I was totally I'm honored. I'm honored to be on with you.
It's like
Let's put
we've been on parallel tracks,
it
me above the ground and you in the ground, so to speak. And
Yeah.
Dan, you've spent your whole life eating and growing organic food. Is that right? How did you get started?
I got started because my parents started a homestead organic farm in 1980 when I was 3 years old. So I didn't really have a lot of choice in it. As well, they, for their day job, were running the organic farming movement here in the northeast corner of the U.S. Helped write some of the first organic standards in the country in the 80s, and so I was effectively born to it. I was effectively born to it.
And where are you? Are you in Massachusetts?
Massachusetts, yep, in New England we call it. The northeast quadrant of the US.
Ah, yes, that's where you kicked the British out, wasn't it? It was a.
That's where we started the revolution from. Yeah, Massachusetts, Boston. Yep.
That's where America went to coffee, and we stuck with tea.
We did chuck some tea into the ocean as part of our
Yeah.
yes, checking things off there. Yeah, exactly.
And as founder and director of the BioNutrient Institute, you can actually measure what's in food. How long have you been doing this? And how do you do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I founded the organization in 2010 with an objective of, primarily sharing with growers what I'd come to after effectively 30 years of experience when I finally figured out how to make a living farming, which foundationally includes having plants be healthy, as in pest and disease resistant, as in they have got strong immune systems, which correlates with flavor and aroma and nutrition for us. So, after, teaching courses and setting up conferences and things like that for a number of years in 2017, started working with scientists effectively to answer the question, how big is a nutrient variation in food? A, we thought it was significant. How well does it connect with soil health and plant health? We thought there was direct connections there. And could you actually build handheld meters to test that variation with, should it be significant, with a flash of light? None, basically. Obviously, we're wired for testing nutrient levels with our very sophisticated nutrient monitoring systems called noses and tongues. If you eat a tomato that tastes good, that's dramatically nutritionally different than a tomato that doesn't. There are some fairly simple handheld tools that have been around for 180, 90 years. One called a refractometer, which is a great way to get an empirical number if you want to get an empirical number, but it's not calibrated to specific nutrients and levels and ratios. So there's a number of ways of testing with your God-given senses, with very simple instrumentation like refractometers, with a lot of the work we do is in labs with expensive, $500,000 pieces of equipment. So it's a burgeoning field. And it seems like there's a bunch of really nice connections there between soil health, ecosystem function, carbon sequestration, farm viability, obviating the need for agrochemicals, increased nutrient levels. We would argue potentially reversing a lot of chronic disease states. I always refer to the quote from Linus Pauling about at the root of every chronic disease is a nutritional deficiency, which you probably could reference or speak to more well than myself. But yeah.
No, it's fascinating. I was playing around with one of those refractometers the other day, and the essence is you squeeze a bit of juice out of a plant onto the refractometer, and you look through the lens towards light, and there's a dial, there's a line that moves up, and
Yeah.
I believe the higher up it is, the more nutrient dense or the more polyphenols. I'm not sure exactly what it's measuring. In my plot of land, the thing that won the most was actually the weeds. They were very high on this scale. So what is it measuring when you use a refractometer?
It's measuring total dissolved solids, so the amount of stuff in the sap of the plant. And effectively, the more watery it is, the emptier it is nutritionally, the lower the number. And the more stuff is in there, the more viscous it is, the more it bends the light and the higher the number becomes. So
So if I want to
it's
sell, many pounds, kilos of carrots, and I can force them to grow very fast and absorb a lot of water, they'll be sort of crispy, crunchy, relatively tasteless, and they won't score very well on this meter. So that's basically
Precisely.
how it works. Yeah.
Yep. Which is effectively what our the supply chain, at least here in the West, is primarily made up of, is crops that have been, jacked up synthetically with fertilizers, which just causes them to grow rapidly, but does not cause them to grow well.
Yeah, I just ate an apparently organic carrot from a supermarket and compared it to one of my carrots, and the taste difference is just, it's like chalk and cheese. I'm not sure I can eat those supermarket carrots anymore. But when I go into a shop, I'm thinking carrots are going to give me beta carotene. I'm thinking tomatoes will give me lycopene. I think oranges are going to give me vitamin C and so on. But how much variation in nutrient content are you finding in food?
Well, it depends on which nutrients you're looking at, because obviously there's or maybe not obviously, but the more we're looking into it now and identifying all the different nutrients in food, it seems like there's probably many millions of different types of nutrients, like vitamin C or polyphenols or antioxidants or calcium. So if you want to look at a couple sort of, families or types of nutrients, what we found is that in the elemental range, like with calcium and potassium and phosphorus and sulfur, the range may be a 4x or an 8x range, as in this carrot has as much sulfur as those 4 carrots, or if phosphorus 8x. When we're looking at polyphenols and antioxidants, some of those secondary metabolites that correlate more well with flavor and aroma and sort of health-giving attribute, it's maybe 20x or 40x. So you'd have to eat 40 of these carrots to get as many antioxidants if you ate one of those carrots. That seems to be roughly the range,
It's
which is
quite a
quite dramatic.
yeah. No, it
It's
really
roughly
is.
3% or 4%. It's, yeah.
I remember years ago, well, two very simple exercises. One was the dietitian's Bible called McCanson-Widdowson, and you look up how much vitamin C, for example, is in an orange, and
Right.
it will tell you whatever, 60 milligram or something. And then They're little numbers which relate to references. So if you look in the back and you go to the references of the studies, you find an extraordinary variation. And that sort of 60 milligram per orange is just an average.
Exactly.
And my colleague years ago, Dr. Michael Colgan, I remember him saying he went to an orange grove and picked up an orange and went to a supermarket and picked up an orange and analyzed them. And he could find, I think it was up to 180 milligram of vitamin C in the orange picked that day from the orange grove. And in some of the supermarket oranges, he couldn't actually detect any vitamin C at all.
Precisely. Precisely. Yes, that's exactly correct.
Yeah.
It's remarkably dramatic how varied the nutrient levels are in food. And I think in many cases, it's one of those things we don't think about. We just, the bag of carrots says in the back, you know,
yeah.
18 milligrams of vitamin A, and you just assume that's what it has. And in fact, it's not been assessed. The variation is massive. And there's some very powerful connections there to human health and to ecosystem health.
Now, I was having a chat with some famous celebrity who said, oh, I don't need supplements. I have a Brazil nut every day, and that gives me all my selenium. And in fact, one of my friends and colleagues, professor of chemistry at Reading, Surrey University, had actually analyzed Brazil nuts, and same thing. Some, no selenium. Others, selenium, which of course is very soil dependent. What about some of these trace elements like iron and zinc and copper? Do they vary a lot? I mean, that surely must be primarily down to what's in the soil.
What I was saying was the basic elements like copper and zinc and sulfur and phosphorus do vary in that sort of 2x to 10x kind of range. And to a large degree, it is affected by what is present in the soil, but it seems that the primary factor in determining how many nutrients are in the plant is the health of the microbiome of the plant, the level of life in the soil. So you can potentially have a lot of iron in the soil, but if you don't have the function to get it into the plant, it can be not in the plant in good levels. So like we evolved, you know, we're evolved by microbes, you know, plants were also evolved by microbes. And like we can't really digest our food without a functioning microbiome, neither can plants. And so.
And that is a really fascinating area, how the microbiome of the soil is directly affecting the nutrient uptake into the plants. And just before we go into that in a bit more detail, of course, a lot of people are talking about organic or biodynamic or zero dig or regenerative farming methods. And you've got the chance to actually measure things. Are they necessarily better? Can I, for example, trust that an organic carrot will be better than another kind of carrot?
No. No. It has everything to do with the level of life in the soil. And just because you can check the boxes to be certified organic does not mean that you have high levels of life in the soil. Just because you engage in practices that are required to be regenerative does not mean you have accomplished the function of life flourishing well in the soil. So it's really about the result, not about the process. You know, if you do 10 Hail Marys, are you then able to have a direct conversation with Jesus? Or are you just going through the motions of doing the Hail Marys and not actually engaging deeply in that spiritual plane? I think it's almost exactly the same with farming. It's not about the label. It's not about the certification. It's not about the claim. It's about the actual level of vitality of the system.
So how do you measure the life in soil?
Like everything else, there's very sophisticated ways and very rudimentary ways. The simple, you know, a simple way would be to do what's called a respiration test. So you would take, you know, a quantum of soil, you know, 10 milligrams or whatever, and dry it out, and you put it in a container, and you add a certain amount of water, and then you close the container, and you put this little paddle in, which tests for CO2. And, you know, at so many hours, you've got so much respiration, so much CO2 has been out breathed by the microbes, and you can effectively see the amount of, basically the amount that the soil life is breathing connects to the amount of life in the soil. That would be a very rudimentary fashion. There's all kinds of really much more sophisticated fashions where you can do RNA analysis and identify hundreds of species of multiple kingdoms and concentration ranges and things as well. So there's lots of different ways of doing it.
But in essence, the soil is breathing as we are, and the microbiomes are presumably consuming oxygen and producing carbon dioxide?
Precisely, yeah. There's aerobes and anaerobes, but you know, a lot of the microbes in the soil are aerobes, which means they breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. So,
and the anaerobes,
they don't need air to. Mm-hmm. They don't need oxygen to breathe. There's functional anaerobes and pure anaerobes as a whole. I mean, you get down two steps into the rabbit hole on any of these topics, and it rapidly becomes a whole, you know, a whole fractal web of detail. But
yeah, and when we hear that actually the soil and the topsoil particularly can capture carbon, mm-hmm. you know, it's very important, carbon capture. Presumably that's part of this process of the living organisms within it consuming.
Well, the foundational way that organic matter is built, that carbon is you know, put into the soil, is through photosynthesis. So mm-hmm. plants are green because they have this, you know, photosynthesis occurs in their leaves, and that is a recipe which includes carbon dioxide plus water plus sunlight equals oxygen and sugar. And the oxygen is emitted out of the leaf into the atmosphere, and the sugar in nature is emitted into the soil to feed the microbes. And C6H12O6, you've taken C out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil. And so that process of plants feeding microbes, because that's how they have evolved to eat, is a process of soil building. It's the plants that built the soil, right? Before we had land plants, we didn't have soil. We had dirt. It wasn't a living matrix.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have high levels of carbon in it. It was just the mineral quotient.
So the plants build the soil and feed the microbes. The plants release oxygen. The microbes release a little bit of carbon dioxide as well, but mm-hmm. less than the plants. It always felt to me very much like the film The Matrix, that perhaps the plant's function is to feed all those microbes in the soil. They're really running the show, and they've created these wonderful plants that reach out and gather nutrients and basically feed them, among other things, sugars. That's what the plants are creating, isn't it?
It's a very nuanced, there's all kinds of, you know, plant root exudates they're called broadly. There's amino acids, it's a really sophisticated signaling framework where the plant says, I want some copper. And so it then exudes these different nutrients which stimulate the copper solubilizers, and they reproduce, and they go and solubilize copper and put it into an organic matrix and feed it to the plant. Life is really sophisticated and brilliant and profound. And, you know, it's nice to have the scientific language to appreciate it, but I don't think we'll ever understand the nuances. I mean, or do we need to? Once we understand the pattern of life, I think our role is just to be caretakers.
It seems that that is really the biggest jump away from the sort of egotistical style of, pharmacological farming, where we say a plant needs nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium to grow, and we'll sort of kill everything we can that gets in the way, force this NPK into the soil and get mm-hmm. plants. And out of that arrogance, we've created a lot of problems. So now we're starting to, you know, go back and realize that actually maybe humanity doesn't rule the world. It could even be the soil microbiome. Now, this microbiome, is it, as you know, we talk about the human microbiome as thousands and thousands of different bacteria and fungi and even viruses. Is that similar in the soil?
Exactly. Yeah. And millions of species, you know, most of which don't even have names yet. It's like, it's, you know, what percentage of the universe is dark matter? Like, you know, 95% we can't even find. 95% of the species in the soil don't even have names yet. It's profoundly sophisticated and nuanced.
It's always been extraordinary for me to think that all the rubbish that we create, I mean, anything we create and we bury in the ground, how the earth is able to really detoxify, break everything down. It's quite extraordinary.
You know, mycorrhizae, fungi, I mean, they can digest dioxin, PCBs, you know, radioactive isotopes, you know, herbicides, fungicides. Microbes have really, they're extremely sophisticated beings. They have really powerful faculties. They can do a lot of things that we can't do in our labs, you know. So full respect to the bottom, quote unquote, of the food chain.
Yeah, I had a lovely podcast with Bob Quinn, who you'll know has managed to get 8,000 acres growing organic in Montana and Saskatchewan, mm-hmm. and Tim Parton, who's a real advocate of regenerative farming. And one sort of interesting point of friction was that, you know, Bob's absolutely against glyphosates, as I guess I would say, you know, I am too.
Mm-hmm.
And funny enough, his Kamut Khorasan wheat, which is grown completely organically in the middle of nowhere, just failed a very, very high standard they have in Italy. I think they have to have less than 10 parts per billion of glyphosates, and his was 12 or 13.
Yep.
And he was shocked. It was totally nothing that he would have added. It turned out to be rainwater. And meanwhile, Tim was telling me that they have a process at some part of growing some plant where they use a very small amount of glyphosate and then some process that digests it. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, can these microbiomes also digest glyphosates?
100%. We've got many examples of farmers that are organic but are engaging in practices that are relatively destructive to the soil, failing exactly as you're saying, failing some of these rigorous glyphosate residue tests. Whereas farmers who are not organic and are putting down glyphosate in small quantities but strategically are passing the glyphosate tests, and it's raining glyphosate on both farms, and the one farm used it, but it's not showing up in the plant because the process of managing the soil microbiome well has a concomitant effect of toxins being digested by the microbiome. Yeah, it's as somebody who grew up on an organic farm whose parents ran an organic farming organization, this is not the storyline that you would think I would be telling, except, you know, I happen to be enough of a scientist to trust good data. And even when it disagrees with my philosophical framework, say, well, maybe I'm wrong. You know, that's the principle of science here.
Well, it's very interesting because I know that a lot of farms that have converted to organic, you know, many years later, are still finding some, you know, residues of pesticides, herbicides. But this suggests that there are things that can be done that it will start to break down these compounds much more quickly and clean up the soil. In many cases, it can happen in months.
It's not a long-term process necessarily, if you know what you're doing. Yeah.
Are there any hot tips? Without going into vast details of ways to help to clean up the soil and break down things like glyphosate residues?
Well, the hot tip is to create a dynamic where life flourishes, which is the whole point of the course I'll be giving.
Mm-hmm.
I've got, you know, five different sort of key environmental conditions that must be maintained for microbes to function. It's really about just creating a dynamic where the microbes have everything they need to flourish. And I would say that's your, you know, from a broad spectrum perspective, that's your role as a farmer, as a gardener, as a land steward, however you want to identify, is to ensure that life has what she needs to function, and then get out of the way, stop messing with her.
And let's go into those fundamental principles. But just before that, there's a sort of general view that what we need is a big diversity of microbiome. This is what's happening in the human microbiome world, that more variety is necessarily better. Is that true in the soil?
Yep. And certain species can be pathogenic. So, you know, I mean, you can have a a fungal infection on a human or a fungal infection on a plant that could be pathogenic. But when you get that diversity and balance in place, you know, effectively, the greater the diversity And the greater the levels, the more well-functioning the system, the greater the resilience, et cetera.
And if soil is very stressed, what happens to the diversity?
It diminishes. They die out. It's a continuum, you know, from vitality to death, to from soil to dirt.
The reason I raise that is something we're finding very interesting in relation to cancer. Mm-hmm. And this is slightly different. But when a cell is very stressed and moves into a cancerous state, it seems to create in the nucleus a big variety of mutations.
Mm-hmm.
The concept being, and of course, wrongly, the idea has been that it's those mutations that are causing the cancer. Mm-hmm. But it looks like it's the other way around, that when a system is in a state of stress, it kind of scrambles and produces a lot of variations of microorganisms, or in this case, of genes,
right,
in order to try and survive. So I was just wondering, you know, whether it's just this linear idea, which is running into a few problems in relation to the microbiome, that more is always better, so to speak.
Well, like I said, you can have Phytophthora or Rhizoctonia or Pythium that could be the soil-borne, you know, bacterial pathogens, which can be present at high levels. And, you know, in many cases, when they are present at high levels, that correlates with nature effectively having them eat the plant because the plant's not fit for reproduction. But yeah, I mean, like I said, it's still remarkably early days in teasing out the full suite of all the nuances. But it sure does look like the broader the diversity of the families and the genera, you know, in the various kingdoms, you want archaea, you want bacteria, you want fungi, there's all kinds of different subcategories. Then there's the soil food web, the sort of the things you can see, the arthropods and you know, ciliates, and I mean, it really is a profound teeming ecosystem when it's functioning well.
So let's touch on some of those fundamental principles that you're going to be talking about when we do our two-day workshop in the Black Mountains, Wales, on June the 19th and 20th.
Yeah, well, one at a time or the full suite?
Yeah, a little bit on each one would be great.
So, as we said earlier, you know, a lot of soil microbes are aerobes. And so when your soil is too tight and there's no air, then they asphyxiate. So, you know, I say put a plastic bag over a chicken's head or a cow's head or a child's head, and they're going to die. It's the same with microbes. They need air to breathe. So managing your soil in such a fashion as to have sufficient air flow and circulation is a critical environmental condition, one which is oftentimes overlooked by a lot of people, because it's hard to sell a product that adds air. So most of the people who are farming have been trained by people who have an agenda to sell them things. And this really fits in many cases. Aeration is a critical component. Hydration is also very important. If you are not able to maintain hydration through the growing season, you know, if you just don't water a cow for a week or a kid for a week, they'll probably die. And similarly, if your soil is dry for a week, most of the microbes will die off. So air and water, right? They're foundational for life. In many cases, we are thinking about our plant, we're not thinking about the microbiome. And so maybe watering the place where the stem hits the ground, but 4 inches away or 8 inches away, it may be powder dry in the beating down summer. Maybe not where you are in Wales, but a lot of places. So air, water, food is the next one. Obviously you need to feed your children. You need to feed your cats and your chickens. Microbes need food to eat. And so, you know, where I live here in Massachusetts in the wintertime, we don't have green leaves on the ground for 4 or 5 months in a row. So if the plants are feeding the microbes when they've got green leaves through that, you know, photosynthetic pathway, what happens when there's nothing green above ground? Well, the microbes aren't being fed. And so in nature, you don't see bare soil, you see cover, you see dead organic matter in the soil, because that will feed the microbes when the plant is not able to photosynthesize. So air, water, and food, right? These are none of them revolutionary concepts, but in many cases, they are the limiting factors behind systems functioning well. I'm a big fan of minerals because I understand the role of enzymes and enzyme cofactors and biochemistry. There's a lot of things that leach out of the soil, boron and sulfur and molybdenum. It's called anions. So when it rains, they leach if you don't have good soil structure. So if you're in a place like Wales where maybe farming's been going on for thousands of years and tillage for a bunch of it and decent amount of rain happening on a regular basis, in many cases, you don't have enough boron in the soil for critical enzyme systems to function. And that's an inherent limiting factor. Think about sulfur and the sulfur enzymes. Think about B12 and cobalt. And, you know, the nitrogenase enzyme has molybdenum at the center of it. So you need a sufficient suite of a broad suite of spectrum of elements for life to function. Those enzyme systems are effectively uniform across the kingdoms. The bacteria and the fungi and the plants and the animals all use the same enzymes, which have at their core the same elements for these core crucial functions.
So that suggests you got to remineralize the soil and presumably analyze it and find out what is or isn't there and then take the appropriate action.
Yep. Mm-hmm. With all these broad strokes, then there's ways of assessing and ways of proactively managing. And depending on your individual soil's history, it may have different imbalances than your neighbors. And so it really is like each human is an individual system. Every piece of land is an individual system. So it's not like there's a cookie cutter protocol for any piece of land. It's really about identifying these deficiencies and addressing them. The final one I like to talk about is the microbiome. And the obviously you would like to have at birth for a mammal, you know, we get colostrum, which establishes our gut flora, and without which we will be colicky and fail to thrive. Ideally, for the plant at germination, you'd like to have inoculation. So birth and germination are effectively similar, and we call it inoculation with plants, but we call it colostrum with mammals. It's effectively the same thing. You want to ensure a full suite of symbiotic microbes present at that moment. So minerals, microbes, food, water, air, none of it is particularly revolutionary, but in many cases, one or another of these limiting factors is what's inhibiting people's systems. If you want to talk about a sixth one, I like to talk about the role of consciousness and intention as well. I think there's a lot to that. Got lots of examples where people applying prayer or intention or meditation or, you know, kind words, gentle gentle feelings to their plants have some pretty powerful effects as well. So there's definitely a quantum consciousness attribute because we are dealing with life, and life is, as far as I'm concerned, quite a profound thing.
You remind me of various biodynamic principles. Sometimes there's burying bone, for example, which must be a great way of remineralizing the soil, and planting at certain times in relation to the moon and so on. So quite a lot of consciousness going into biodynamic practices.
There's a profound insight there, and there's a ton of insight in organic, and the permaculturalists have a lot to offer. And the regenerative movement is really, you know, focusing on some important things, and conventional agronomy and soil science has understood a lot. You know, we've got all kinds of wisdom out there. It's just a question of understanding it from the perspective of life, not from our religious or dogmatic or mechanistic perspective.
And one thing I want to ask when you talk about aerating the soil is, you know, there's a big movement towards no dig. We here in Forest Barn, we are both no dig and organic in conversion. And so zero dig sort of implies you don't dig. And if you don't dig, you're not turning the soil. Obviously, tillage is about turning the soil. But the argument against deep tillage is it breaks up the microbiome. So, yeah, just explain that area a little bit.
Well, I think there are various tools you can use to assess the relative, you know, structure of the soil, how tight or how loose it is. So if you want to be engaging a sort of an empirical framework, you could use what's called a penetrometer, and you can effectively push this probe into the soil, and at 2 inches or 4 inches or 6 inches or a foot, you can measure the amount of pounds per square inch of pressure required to push that probe into the soil. And that correlates very nicely with aeration and structure. And so there are many ways to loosen the soil without tilling. You know, the central point is that you must have air in the soil. And so it's really, and this is what we go into in the course, is the 18 different ways of looking at it and engaging it. I would say, if you've got a very tight soil, there's no microbiome there to kill in the first place. And so what are you worried about? I mean, if you can get some minerals spread and some inoculants spread, and you can go through with that tiller and loosen the soil up and create a dynamic where the microbes now have what they need to function, that could be a strategic act at the beginning of a transition from a perennial pasture ecosystem to an annual, you know, vegetable ecosystem, that would be very wise. So it's not the cow, it's the how, it's not the tillage is good or tillage is bad. It's all things have a time and place based on a series of factors. And it's a hopefully a sensitive and delicate, but intelligent engagement. In many cases, the soils we're working with have been abused for millennia, and we need to understand where they sit in their continuum of possibility and understand the limiting factors inhibiting them from being what they could be, and then be pragmatic about how to move them from where they are to where they could be. So,
you talk about inoculation. How do you inoculate seeds?
I would, at the most simple, you take spores of a suite of different microbes, and they can come in a 1 ounce package, you know, which might cost, I'm using American numbers, ounces and feet and inches and dollars, but you know, $5, mm-hmm. which is, what is it, 3 pounds or 3.5 mm-hmm. pounds.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how many grams an ounce is. It's 20 something grams or something, but mm-hmm. That can be good for 50 pounds of seed, which is 22 kilograms of seed. So, mm-hmm. And you literally take the spores, you take a pinch of the spore and you put it into the seed packet. And I mean, open the seed packet, put a pinch of powder into the seed packet, close the seed packet and shake it up and you're done. You just want to ensure that the suite of spores are present on the coat of the seed when it germinates. It's so extremely expensive and simple.
Yeah, very simple. So that gets the microbiome right there at birth, so to speak.
Yeah,
and then exactly. and then the minerals. What sort of things are we adding to remineralize the soil and get it good?
You can go all the way from specific, call them vitamins, like copper sulfate or manganese sulfate or sodium molybdate, to raw things like sea salt and rock dust, basalt and granite. You know, again, you want to understand what your limiting factors are, and you want to talk about what budget is, you know, look at your scale. Between seawater and rock dust, we have all the minerals we would ever need to remineralize the entire planet. And because the oceans are made out of seawater and the continents are made out of rock, there's no shortage of those things available. And but you know, when you've got weathered soils that are demineralized, you must remineralize in some fashion. So whether you're buying the products of industry like copper sulfate or zinc sulfate, or you're going out and harvesting seawater, or taking the waste product from a quarry, which is crusher dust, which is effectively what the glaciers, you know, leave when they're done grinding up the rock is rock dust. There's a suite of different things you can do.
And
All of that
see,
will, of
yeah, we
course.
got a lot of seaweed here in Wales. That could be useful.
Seaweed is wonderful. It has a bunch of other nutrients in it, but I'm talking about straight seawater, sea salt. There's 92 different elements in sea salt, right? That's all the naturally occurring elements, I think, in the periodic table. All the rest are synthesized. You know, in the same way that I think it was the Romans that salted the fields of the Carthaginians. You know, too much salt is a bad thing, but if you're making soup and you don't have any salt in it at all, it may be a bit bland. You put a little bit of salt in, and it's all of a sudden the flavors come together wonderfully. You put too much salt in, and you can't eat it. In that same way, sort of all these things come with recommended application rates.
Yeah, I was just reading in Switzerland, and going back just to 1920, they had an extraordinarily high rate of goiter and cretinism. You know, it was around then in the 20s and 30s they finally worked out that it was to do with iodine. So there, you know, there are big chunks of the States, you know, pretty much. My friend Craig Sams had an idea that the sort of the Bible Belt, inland America, was very low in iodine, and which creates thyroid problems, creates tiredness, creates all sorts of issues, including goiter. It is extreme. And he thought that all those evangelists that you could go and visit on Sunday would get you excited because people were actually lacking energy from the effect of the lack of the minerals affecting their thyroid and so on.
Interesting. There was an agronomist named Dr. William Albrecht who looked at the U.S. military acceptance rates in World War I based on geographic type, and saw that in Appalachia, the more weathered soils, the boys were accepted at much lower rates because physiologically they were not. I mean, they had flat feet and bad teeth, whereas the boys that grew up in the Midwest, in the deep, fertile prairie soils, had much better physiological development. So we've got great evidence that, you know, what nutrients are and are not in your soil connects to your physiological development. And, you know, it sure looks like your hormonal balance or imbalance, you know, which connects to emotional states and your chronic disease state, susceptibility, or you know, it really is deeply interrelated and quite exciting.
And
As
these,
far as
yeah, these sort of ocean-based nutrients are really cool because up in the Wash area on the east coast of the UK, we have the largest number of centenarians. That part of the country was under the sea, so it's very rich in nutrients like selenium. And in Africa, there was some very good research which showed that those areas very low in selenium have much higher rates of HIV and AIDS-related deaths. Than the coastal areas, or I think Sierra Leone, which again had this sort of rich selenium related soil. So tell me about your workshops and the one we're going to do. How do they work? Do you get your hands dirty? Do we need to know anything before we arrive?
Well, it used to be a 6-day course, which would be one day every 2 months for the entire year, which involved a lot of hands getting dirty. I've condensed it down to 2 days over, you know, because people, you know, for better or worse, don't end up showing up every 2 months for an entire year, and then you lose continuity. So it's primarily you know, indoors conversation, question and answer. You know, I call it my 12-hour stand-up show. I, you know, show up with a basic handout and a whiteboard and a blackboard, or a butcher block piece of paper, and we walk through all these things, explaining the science, and then, you know, going to the practical how-to. So ideally people have some experience. They are growers. It doesn't really matter what the scale is, but they have practical experience and they've got questions. And it's really about empowering growers to get better results. I absolutely digress on topics, metaphysical and, you know, occasionally political. So it's a rollicking conversation. And, you know, talk about the vision and the potential here of how agriculture done well could reverse climate change, reverse chronic disease, you know, bring a much higher level of function to our cultural state. I mean, the vision here is that the more well we are, the more well our culture and our environment are, and we have power in that process by choosing the best food for ourselves and our families. So we like to leave people feeling, you know, not only empowered practically, but inspired as well.
And will we learn some of the sort of simple tests so we can understand that our soil is coming back to life?
Absolutely. It's absolutely in depth, detail specifics. This is how you read a soil test. This is how you make your recommendations. This is how you harvest your inoculants. This is what you're looking for if you're buying them. These are techniques for maintaining aeration. This is how nature facilitates hydration. we're using nature as a model and saying nature figured this whole thing out, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago. And so in nature, you know, in areas where humans aren't bothering things, they seem to do just fine. And so how can we create that dynamic in the area where we are bothering things? How does nature evolve it to work? And what are the things that are inhibiting nature from functioning well in our land?
Now, you've been down here at Forest Farm Retreat. It's a rather wonderful place with
gorgeous.
Lots of...
Inside and outside, yes.
Yeah, no, it really is a little bit of heaven. It's kind of in the molar tooth of four mountains, and I do believe it's probably been organic forever because we are at the very end of the lane. We have otters and owls and other such creatures. And also, by the way, for this occasion, we're bringing in a celebrity chef. I don't mean a chef who is themselves a celebrity, but cooks for the celebrities, Dan Lefeur. And he and his partner, Polly, run an organic garden as well. So they're very well experienced. And we're in the process right now of planting as much as we can so we can feed everybody as much as we can from the land right here. And also, since you kindly visited this place a few weeks ago, actually, we have two people joining us, Ella and Michael, who have a ton of experience in growing foods organically, biodynamically, and are full of lots of interesting experience and ideas. So they're going to be your avid students soaking up everything, because what we want to do here is create a way of making optimum nutrition really happen in food. So for me, I was born in a six-floor flat in London. I mean, I didn't even have a window box. You know, it would have killed anyone if it had fallen off. So I kind of came from that urban environment. So it's both scary and exciting to now be in this rich natural environment with a mission, not just to grow as much food as we possibly can to feed everybody who comes through the retreats here, but also have that food be as nutritious as it can possibly be.
Beautiful. I think your space is a beautiful space. It's really, really nice. And yeah, as much as I can help support that process, I'm happy to. And I'm certainly we'll get into the garden and walk through and talk about things and look at things, your field there during the course, but it wouldn't be a majority of the event.
And you'll bring a biometer or two so we can kind of see how that process works as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to have reflect timers for people if they want to take them home as well. Oh,
that's fantastic. Well, Dan, thank you very much, because you have really uniquely put your eye on this absolutely critical ball. Lots of theories out there, but what are those fundamental principles that if we adhere to them, allow the soil and the plants that nourish us and feed us to you know, do the job really well and to connect us back to nature. I believe by 2035, two-thirds of the world's population will be urbanized. So that very idea of being connected to nature is, you know, receding for a lot of people.
Oh, let's hope that's not the case. Let's hope that we reverse that trend and help people reoccupy the land. I think we belong in, you know, symbiotic relationship with nature. I think we're animals, belong in nature. I think it's part of the perversion of culture is the removal, our removal from the land and from practical life. But yes, these are really important topics and conversations. And the more we get out of phase with life, the more likely we are to die is what it comes down to as far as I'm concerned. So it's really survival.
So thank you, Dan, so much for your time. And if anyone listening would like to come on this workshop, which is reasonably exclusive because we don't have so many places, please go to foodforthebrain.org and click on the events section and you'll see all the details. The workshop itself is on June the 19th and the 20th. So it's a two-day workshop. If you're coming to stay, then you'll need to arrive on the 18th and we'll make you a sumptuous feast. So that's it. June 18th, 19th, 20th, foodforthebrain.org. Go to events. Dan, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your time.
Thank you, Patrick. Looking forward to it.